Hello, and welcome to Millennial 2017, number 19, I believe it is. And this is with, how do you pronounce your name?
Thomas Baden-Reese, but I will accept Baden-Rice. That's what a lot of people pronounce it as.
Right, okay. Thomas Baden-Reese.
And, exactly.
I'll try to get that right. And, So we agreed that he would be. I would describe him as an alt-centrist firebrand. He created his channel. He's obviously an English guy, and he created his channel. Well, when did you start? I mean, I think I first became aware of you around about January or February.
Yes. Well, I actually started back in 2014, so it was just about 6 months after you. And I was very much into things like Madeleine McCann and 9/11. When I first began, and then eventually I moved into things like, you know, the anti-racism campaign and immigration, and then eventually I sort of moved on to the more personal level red pill stuff. And that was because I found in 2016 I came across your channel, and you were dealing with more of the kind of the personal aspects, you know, the sort of the way the problems with modernity, the way that we're all depressed and miserable these days. And so your channel was very much a sort of red pill on the personal level for me. And once I sort of got into that, I sort of then started incorporating more personal kind of red pill stuff onto my channel.
Yeah, it's interesting because my own channel has become incorporated into the broader alt-right movement. But when I started it was really just a personal, I wasn't affiliated or allied with anything, and it was really just me talking about the world and my own mental illness or struggle with mental illness, whatever, and what I saw as the problems in the world. So, and my interest was always psychological, so it made sense to sort of tackle it from that direction. But since the channel has subsequently become part of the alt-right movement to some extent, it's become sort of unique in that way, because most things in the alt-right are more cultural, social, political, and so on.
Yeah.
So, I mean, for what it's worth, I always feel that, I mean, I think people like my videos about, the culture, society and all that, but mm-hmm. I would like to return to stuff that I was doing in the first place, because I think that's what I'm best at and it's what I am most fascinated by. But anyway, we shouldn't be talking about me.
I would say you do all things well, Woz. So it's not just it's not just the personal stuff you do well, you also do the political and cultural stuff, but I think that was the unique thing about your channel. And it's funny that I admire the fact that you always knew that there was something wrong with the kind of the culture of modernity, and that you ever put up a channel and believed that there would be other people out there who would share your opinions. Because I'll tell you something, if someone had to come to me before I found your channel and suggested setting up a channel that would be dedicated to these sort of themes about, you know, the cultural depravity of the age, the fact that we're all sort of depressed and atomized individuals, I would have told that person, don't bother doing that kind of thing on YouTube. So it was very kind of, I felt there was something reassuring when I came across your channel in 2016 and found it was very, very popular. So, you know, that's what I wanted to say.
Well, thank you very much. I think that I had no idea how many people there were out there who would want to see it. I remember saying to someone, I think the channel will top out at about 500 subscribers. And because I had no idea whether I was any good at it, and also, as I say, how many people would actually be interested in it. So I really didn't know. And at the time, the only other stuff that I was using as a sort of touchstone was a website called Theden.tv, which neo-reaction, the reactosphere. But that was much smaller and more obscure, more esoteric than the alt-right is today. And more highbrow a lot of the time than the alt-right is today, because the alt-right has grown, it has become more populist, and especially since the Trump thing. So that was the milieu that the channel immersed from, and I didn't you know, I thought it would remain obscure. I really had no, and this is why I put my face up on screen. It's why, and I, why I was so uninhibited about saying things, which nowadays I just would never say. Because the environment is so different.
Yes, yes. I was very naive at the beginning.
Yeah, you have to learn this the hard way. You know, it's like, you reveal something thinking, well, this is good because I'm being honest, I'm being direct, and I'm giving them the true picture of me and how I see the world and my reasons for seeing the world the way I do. But actually, it can be used against you. And there are also things that some people just don't want to know. It's quite a delicate balancing act.
Yes, I guess so. I guess when I started, I didn't realize how stupid the average member of the public was and how they will not listen to, you know, they will never be reasonable about certain things you say, the vast majority of people. And that was a steep learning curve, which I had to go through.
Yeah. Do you have anything like... Well, for example, my bestiality bugbear. You know, I made one fucking video about it in the end of, I think it was the end of 2015, and then I mentioned it in a speech at the end of 2016. And thereafter, A, it's apparently an obsession of mine, and B, I'm apparently pro-bestiality. You know, this is fucking cretinous. Yeah, they say that I was advocating and saying that there was nothing wrong with it. That this is the level of public discourse. Of course, it's stirred up by, you know, enemies on the left.
Mm-hmm.
But there are lots of people who go along with it. They just say, oh, you must be progressive.
I've seen the way people go for you with that, and it's really just disgusting and stupid. I will say, Woz, that I'm so much luckier than you in some ways, because I've never really had an audience. I've never really had a big audience. And therefore, I was able to get to a point where I thought, you know what, I can take down a lot of my old videos and nobody will ever notice, hopefully. I suspect they're on record somewhere and that they might be repeated back to me at some later point. But I always thought that I was luckier than you. You know, when you got hung out to dry last sort of January, I always thought, you know what, there is some advantage in being a poorly subscribed YouTube channel.
Yeah, you can learn from my mistakes. Yeah, definitely. I think you should. I think everyone should. I mean, again, I didn't know how to stay safe. You know, like, it's common sense that you don't tell people your name and you don't tell them your city or your nearest city. But then there are other things, like, I mean, if you tell them what kind of degree you studied, or, you know, they can use anything against you. Yeah. It's a real shame because, as I say, when I started my channel, it was very much in a spirit of innocence and naivety, and I just wanted to talk to people. I really was desperate to get a lot of things out of my system and meet like-minded people. And to be fair, from the very start, I did meet like-minded people. That happened very quickly. It's amazing. People found the channel who should have found the channel.
Yes.
And I don't know, I imagine that it's been a similar thing for you.
For me, absolutely. It's the first time in my life that I've ever sort of got to be myself. And the people who know me through YouTube, they actually know who I am. Whereas the people who I know in real life, they don't really know, you know, what I'm about. So for me, it was a total relief. It's like a real chance to express myself. And I only have 3,000 subscribers, but I really count my blessings because it's so nice to be able to have an audience, just, you know, maybe 200 people per video.
It's a nice sweet spot.
They understand me.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, it's a nice sweet spot. I mean, I think I think the sweet spot for me was like about 5,000 to 10,000 subscribers. And then beyond that, once I passed that number, the stress increased, the pressure increased. And also the volume of comments increased. And obviously you also get a more lowbrow fringe discovering the channel and finding it. And often I have to, you know, tell people, you know, this just isn't the channel for you. Whereas that never happened in the early days. But there was just a nice feeling of, you know, like, after you've got a few thousand, up to 10,000. I think that's a really nice sweet spot for a channel.
Yes.
Yeah, in my own experience.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, I don't know how these people who, you know, these people who've got like 100,000, you know, I would
be sued anyway.
I don't know about that. I mean, I think I would need to be on beta blockers to handle that, to be honest. the pressure. You know, because if I go like a week without filming a video, I get tremendously nervous about filming a video. And it takes me several days to psych myself up to it, because I know that, well, I always feel that it will be judged by whatever standard is my best so far, the new video will be judged by that. So I always worry intensely about it. And it's ridiculous. Yeah. And then what usually happens is I either force myself to go through with it, which is usually, it results in a not very good video, or eventually it reaches a point where the pressure just sort of dissolves and I just sit down and do it, and it's very easy. That happened, the video I did about the Westminster Bridge attack, I was trying to psych myself up to do that for several weeks, actually. That's how long, it took ages.
Really?
And then suddenly one day, if I recall correctly, or else I was psyching myself up to do some filming, and then the Westminster Bridge thing happened, and I just had to, I can't remember how it happened. But at any rate, once I sat down to do it, suddenly the nerves just dissolved, and I actually had a good laugh doing that video. It turned out to be, given the subject matter, it turned out to be quite a upbeat video. But I remember prior to it, I had been just shitting myself about filming. And it sounds ridiculous because people say, well, you know, each video seems fine, but it's a tremendous, it feels, and maybe I'm taking it far too seriously, being precious about it, but it just feels like a huge responsibility. And it never did when I had like 2,000 subscribers. It was just, certainly the first year, I really didn't give a fuck. I didn't care if my hair was out of place or my shirt was creased or dirty, or you know, my t-shirt was on. There are several videos where I'm wearing my t-shirt back to front, and it didn't even, I didn't even care. But obviously nowadays, you know, I'm, believe it or not, I do put some effort into looking fairly respectable.
Sure.
But yeah, back then it was just, it's hilarious to think of how washed out I was. You know, like I'd been depressed for 10 years, and the first year of the channel is the result of that. It's really, it's very amusing to look back on it. But I do wish that I could get back to, it's funny, you know, ever since I seem to constantly have this craving to return to the first year of the channel, because it feels like that was when it was innocent and authentic. And ever since then, I've been far more aware of who's watching and the expectations and so on. And so it's much less innocent than it was. But the trouble is, you can never go back. You know, it's just like you can never be 15 again or 7 again. You can't do it. And I think in the same way, it is a difficult thing to return a channel to a previous state, a previous version of itself, because that is inherently an unnatural thing to do. But you can change habits in yourself, like mental habits, and that is sincere doing that, and then the results of that will be sincere. So again, it's just another thing that I hope to do in the near future. But anyway, so I suppose we should get onto more topical stuff, because it's weird, you know, with the millennials, I try to talk about the other person, but we've ended up talking about me so far. So that doesn't seem right. That seems selfish of me. So
no, I'm happy to listen to people. I like listening to people in general. So, and I like listening to you. So it's a happy coincidence.
Well, thank you, but I don't want to be indulgent. I mean, let's talk about your own concerns, actually, let's talk about your political evolution, because that's something I've been interested in asking you about. How did you start out? What was Thomas Baden Rees like when he was 15?
Oh, well, 15, I mean, I wouldn't say, I made a video where I said I went through a minor communist phase when I was sort of 16. But then by the time I was 16 and a half, I'd realized that that was an absolute load of nonsense. And then really after that, when I was sort of 17 and 18, I was very disturbed by the world and I wanted to do something to help. I always hated politics. I always thought that was a rubbish thing. It was just a load of nonsense. And I wanted to do something like hands-on to help solve the world's problems. So for example, when I was at first year university, I worked in an Oxfam charity shop. But again, after a year of that, I realized what an absolute load of nonsense that was. That I wasn't helping anyone. There was something fraudulent in it. And so I guess by the time I was 19, I was very completely apolitical and completely just centered. I was basically a very atomized individual. And I guess if you had asked me about what I believed in terms of politics then, I would have said I would be like an elitist who didn't have any faith in the people. But in all honesty, for most of my career, I mean, for most of my life, sorry, I've been apolitical. Back in sort of 2008, I had visions of creating a YouTube channel where I would complain about political correctness. I'd be sort of like a Katie Hopkins. In 2013, I really swallowed the red pill. And so ultimately, I ended up more like a sort of David Icke when I first started. And then as the channel's gone on, I've sort of dropped more into a sort of Katie Hopkins mode, if I can put it like that. So that would be evolution.
You've got a video called Why I Don't Like Muslims, which I think is a hilarious title. That's certainly a title that I wouldn't feel at liberty to use nowadays.
Well, I changed that. I've changed that. That's the thing. I changed that the other day because it's got over 40,000 views now. So I changed that. And that's exactly that's exactly the kind of problem that arises when you get big. You know, not especially big, but 3,000 subscriber big. You have to worry about things like that. And it's irritating, really, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you have to be careful because, again, something that you did in all innocence and naivety, thinking that only like-minded, sympathetic people would see, suddenly has an unsympathetic audience, and it doesn't look innocent anymore. It looks calculated, or they can say that it was calculating. They can say that you're going for a certain effect and all that. And, yeah, it's unfortunate.
Mm-hmm.
So you were. It would be fair to say that you are interested in conspiracy theories.
I would say I'm a conspiracy analyst or a conspiracy realist.
Right. Tell me some. I know that you're a 9/11 truther. Forgive me for using terminology. It's just for the sake of shorthand, and and also the JFK assassination.
I'm not especially big on JFK. It's mainly sort of 9/11 and Madeleine McCann. Those were the two sort of conspiracies that I've sort of looked at.
Well, on the issue of Madeleine McCann, what do you think about Pizzagate?
Well, what I would say I don't know much about Pizzagate, but my feel for it is that it's not quite in the same. There's just something a little bit. It feels like we're being sold something with Pizzagate. It didn't remind me of the real cases like Elm Guest House or the Jersey abuse scandal, which were very much, there was something very genuine about those cases. There was something a little bit phony about Pizzagate from my perspective of not having delved completely into it. What I will say is that, I mean, there were some people saying, the Podesta brothers were the kidnappers of Madeleine McCann. That is clear nonsense. But what I will say is that I think there are some definite connections between Madeleine McCann case and the Podesta brothers and indeed Pizzagate. And I will actually make a video about this in the coming year. But the connections are, they exist, but they're sort of very weak. And they're certainly interesting, but they are certainly not along the lines of the Podesta brothers being the kidnappers of Madeleine McCann.
Yeah, I mean, it is cartoonish to think that these two, God knows how rich they must be. These two guys would just decide, hey, let's, instead of paying, you know, 10 experts to do this, well, why don't we just kidnap that girl ourselves? Yeah, I mean, that's ridiculous.
Yes, yes.
And it's like, you know, Burglar Bill having a striped vest and a swag sack. It's that, that level.
It is, yeah.
But, yeah, that was what made me think of the Pizzagate, when you mentioned Madeleine McCann. I mean, I suppose we could get into individual things about this. Each of these individual conspiracies, as it were. But I think it's perhaps more interesting to speculate about, why do you think these things appeal to you?
Simple. I mean, I'd been brought up on Madeleine McCann. You couldn't miss it in the news. And same with 9/11. And when, I mean, the thing that woke me up is that I read a newspaper article about Madeleine McCann in 2013. I think it was in The Guardian, or it was in The Independent, or it was in The Telegraph. And it was basically saying, there's just no one knows anything about this case. You know, it's a complete mystery. And I thought, well, hang on, no, that's a load of bullshit. Because when the McCanns were first in the news, there was evidence. There was the evidence of the dogs against them. So why, Telegraph, are you writing this stupid article? And that was what prompted me to Google, you know, Madeleine McCann. And I thought I'd find a load of rubbish online, you know, a lot of not very intelligent people saying, you know, spurious things about McCanns. But I ended up finding like the case files and some very intelligent people, sort of professional detectives, all talking about the case and making a lot more sense than the mainstream media were making on it. And that was essentially when I first got red-pilled and I woke up to this idea that, you know, we've been lied to on very many different things.
And why, I mean, obviously you don't have to have an explanation for everything, but why do you think the media would lie about this? And what difference does it make to them?
That is very complicated. I coined the phrase medio politico establishment, which means, I guess, it is the fact that media, politics, and other things like finance are all controlled by the same people, and therefore they sort of work together. But the why, you know, what is the issue with Madeleine McCann and why it's been covering up? That's a very different story. But Woz, I want to say something to you, because I kind of promised my subscribers that I would ask you some specific questions. And I know you're very tired, and you told me you only had 3 hours sleep, but you'd like me to ask these questions.
Yeah, certainly.
Is that okay?
Yeah, that's absolutely fine. Go for it.
I'm sure that...
But again, I just want to say that some people in the text chat are saying that I shouldn't be talking so much about myself. I apologize for that. It's probably because Thomas and I have a good rapport. And so it's just natural, you know, we're just having a casual conversation. I do apologize. It's easy to fall into that. I will try to be more professional. Yes, I did only have 3 hours sleep. It's ridiculous, but I don't know how it happened. Yeah, okay. So, okay, Thomas, let's go for these questions.
Okay, so the main thing that I wanted to get to is the idea of, you talk about deporting all non-white people and indeed mixed race people. Now, I certainly am on board with the idea of deporting non-white people who haven't integrated. But my question is, why would you need to go to the lengths of deporting all non-whites and indeed mixed race people? And to tell people what I'm thinking about here, is this. If you get to the point where you have so much power that you can deport mixed race people, then a priori, you already control all of media and politics and basically everything. And therefore, it's my belief that you don't need to take such extreme measures.
Well, what I would say to that is, I don't think it is necessary to deport all non-white people or mixed race people. What I would do is, there are ways to entice them to leave of their own accord. Just, you know, for example, with Islam, to just ban the building of new mosques, to ban certain practices so that they want to leave. That's one thing. Another thing you could do is pay them to leave, you know, give them some money to set themselves up in their ancestral countries. Another thing you could do, but this is not, this would not be easy, would be to mandate that they could only have one child per couple, because that would obviously have their their numbers in each generation. With each generation, there would be half as many of them. So they would become less of a threat in every way, demographic, cultural, and political, and psychological as well, which perhaps is even more important. So it would not be necessary to deport them all. And then there is another, a sort of stopgap solution, which is to give them basically a city, like to have a Muslim city, mm-hmm. And a black city, and so on, in Britain in the meantime. But I don't think that's, I actually don't think that's a feasible solution to this, because for various reasons. I mean, an Islamic city in the middle of Britain would just become an Islamic stronghold in the middle of Britain, and I don't want that. You know, I think that would be dangerous, very dangerous. So, but then there's the other thing is about mandating that they only have one child per couple. How the fuck do you enforce that? Yeah, this is a serious issue. Yeah, you go.
If I can say, I mean, first of all, on the Islam issue, listen, I've got no problem. If you want to go, this is what I would do if I was in government. I would have no problem with anyone going to the Islamic community. You can say, listen, guys, we know it's not all of you, but it's very clear that Islam is not compatible with the West. So you've got two choices. You can either stop being Muslims and stay in the country, or if you want to practice Islam, that's fine, but you'll have to go back to an Islamic country. And of course, there would be problems with this, because there would be some Muslims who would pretend that they've given up their religion, but they'd still be practicing it. You know, they'd still be practicing their religion. But again, I would have no problem with your alt-right government monitoring these people and basically getting the ex-Muslims who are genuine to rat on the people, the Muslims who are refusing, who are secretly practicing their religion, even though they're pretending that they've given it up. So you could work with the community. You could work with the community to make sure that everyone is stopping them, you know, that they're converting to atheism, let's say. And if that doesn't work, then you can go to the community and you can say, right, well, listen, you get this problem sorted out, and if it's not sorted out within a year, you're all going, you'll all have to go. And so in that sense, you can deal with Islam. But let me say something else about the population rates, because the thing is that, again, I've got no problem. You can make it difficult for people to have kids. You can make it, you know, as in China, you can make it difficult for people to have kids, and you can say to non-white people, you can say, right, you can basically just have two kids. There will be no situation where there'll be Muslims coming in and having, you know, five kids and getting paid, you know, benefits for it. So that is, again, a way of controlling the non-white birth rate. And again, the second thing you can do, you can have it written into stone that the white population must always be 80%. And every year you do a census, and let's suppose it falls down one year to 79%. Well, at that point, because you're in power, because you're the government, you go to certain white people and you say, right, you were going to have two kids. Instead, we're going to pay you and you can have five. So I think all of these things are possible. You can incentivize the white birth rate, and you can decentivize the non-white birth rate.
Yes.
These are eminently possible.
Absolutely. And I think that we should be doing these things. You know, it's not like I'm bent on the idea of having a war or mass deporting millions of people. What I want is for Britain, for the British people, well, let's put it this way, for the English people and the Scottish people and the Welsh people, to be safe. And not just safe, but to have an environment, their ancestral environment, in which they can flourish and be themselves. That is my goal. My goal is not, let's fuck things up for the non-whites. You know,
of course.
So it's not, it's not an anti-non-white position. It's a pro-white position. And in this case, obviously, pro-British.
Yeah.
So I don't want to, I mean, what I predict is that this could work with certain ethnic groups, certain minorities, but others would react in the most, you know, with the most, but they would be outraged by it. And
sense outraged?
Because they would see it as the attack on their demographic that it ultimately would be. I mean,
that's true. But again, I would say because the whole point of the point I'm trying to get across is that if you're ever in the position of power where you can do this, then a priori you sort of control the media politico establishment. You control the media, and if you control the media, you can control people's minds and you can change their mindset. So, but again, if people are gonna, you know, I've got no problem with you deporting anyone who doesn't want to integrate, anyone who is aggravating, anyone, you know, all of these people would have to understand that whites are the native population and that you genuflect to them. And if they're not interested in doing that, then I wouldn't have a problem with you deporting people. The other thing that I wanted to say was concerning the black community and the black, because people will say, well, you know, that's hugely problematic. Well, what I would say is this. If you are in the position of power where you control the media, which you'd have to do if you're ever going to get into the position of deporting people, then you've got a lot of things you can do. The first thing you can do is you can stop the negative role models of black people in the media. You can reinstitute Christian and conservative values back into the black community. You can make it that black people would have to know that if they're going to have children, they had better have stable marriages, this kind of thing. You would also, because you're in government, you would not be flooding the black communities with drugs. And so you could sort things out that way. Now, let's imagine, after you've done all that, there are still problems in the black community. There's still, you know, gangsters, people acting up, people not obeying the law, etc., etc. Well, at this point, you go to people like the Doctor of Common Sense or Tree of Logic, and you say, listen, we're the alt-right, we're in power now, this is what we want you to do. We want you to go into those black communities. We want you to get up a list of all the people, all the troublemakers, and bring that list back to us. And then once you've got that list, you can take action. You can take action against the troublemakers. You don't have to deport them. You can imprison them. You can, you know, you can do whatever you like to them. But in this way, you can enact changes in the black community, which would make it more workable within the, you know, within the Western world.
Yeah. And again, I would be entirely up for that. Perhaps there's a good case for investigating these other solutions or these other courses of action instead of talking all the time about mass deportation. Because after all, mass deportation is alarming to a lot of people. Ultimately, my only goal is the welfare of native European peoples. And because what I, and you know, also the welfare of people in general, but my priority is native Europeans because I see them, just I see the writing on the wall for them.
Yeah, no, there's nothing wrong with that.
And that's the issue. Of course, another issue with deporting, and this goes for whether you're talking about mass deporting or, you know, just individual cases, where do you deport them to? You know, obviously, if they've come within their own lifetimes, then they have an ancestral country. But that ancestral country might just refuse to take them. This is the problem that Germany had with Tunisia, Morocco, and Algeria when the migrant crisis, just after the migrant crisis peaked, and the Germans started to have regrets about what they'd done. They tried to deport lots of people, and these countries simply refused to take them. They simply refused to recognise them as citizens. And it had only been a matter of months since they left.
Yeah.
So that's going to be a huge fucking problem because they know damn well, you know, it's like these oil. It's the same with the oil-rich, you know, Gulf states. They don't actually have a use for their own populace because all they need to do is sell the oil, keep drilling the oil, and keep selling it. And in the same way, Morocco doesn't really have much use for Moroccans. You know, it's better, they know that it's better for them to offload as many Moroccans to Europe as possible. And so it's detrimental for them to allow Moroccans back into Morocco because then they're going to have to do something with them. And so it's better for them just to refuse to recognize them as citizens of Morocco. I mean, it's farcical because, of course, in Europe, we have this idea that your ultimate resource is the humans. It's not the oil or whatever, some natural resource. It's the humans. So you do whatever you can to nurture and, you know, equip them to be culturally, socially, and economically viable. But in other parts of the world, from which we tend to source all these fucking immigrants who come in and cause problems of cohesion, that is not the attitude. So the places to which we would be deporting these people might well not want them. You know, if you said to Somalia, hey, would you like another million Somalians? The answer might well be an enthusiastic no. And then what do you do? You know, this is why in my Erkenbrand speech in, when was it, October, I mentioned the prospect of creating white-run states in Africa, in North Africa, and Sub-Saharan Africa, which would be run by us, but they would be for Africans, Sub-Saharan Africans and North Africans to live in. So we would run them so they would have the benefits of a society run by white people, organization, logistics, and so on. But they would be among their own. And we could deport whoever we wanted to those places. You know, it's not like we would refuse to accept them in our own, you know, when we were in charge of it. So I think that is probably the most equitable solution long term for us and for them, because what they ultimately want is the benefits of our, of, you know, living in our societies, and but they also want to live among their own, because that's human nature. Meantime, deep down, we don't want them living in our societies among us, but we are actually quite okay. The majority of us are quite okay with financing them, subsidizing them, because demonstrably we do, and we continue voting for parties that that do that. And certainly, it's this, it's a small price to pay for, you know, whatever. It's not a huge price to pay. Let's put it that way, to subsidize these third world people. So I think the best solution all round is for us to acquire large areas of land in Africa, and just to send them there, because they would not suffer, and and as I said in the speech, they would actually benefit, because they would no longer have to rub up alongside us on, in daily life, which breeds resentment, you know, suspicion and so on. And meantime, we would get our countries back. So I think it's the least inhumane and most likely scenario here, far more than getting their own countries to take them back, because they don't want them. And it's also better than allowing them to stay in our countries in Europe, because, as I say, long term, I don't think that... I don't think that segregation is going to work. As I said earlier, the Islamic City, fuck's sake, I mean, that's a recipe for an absolute disaster.
No, and I want to emphasize that I think the public and most people who can think rationally will be on board with just saying, look, Islam doesn't work in the West, so it will have to go one way or another. I think nobody will really have a problem with that. I think the problem is when it comes to just, it's the kind of general sort of everybody has to go up to, and including mixed race people. I think that's the thing that which people are not.
Well, of course, The issue of mixed race people is the thorniest one, because of course they don't really belong anywhere, and this is the tragedy of mixed race people. And I get people at least once a month. More than that now, like twice a month, I get some. Person emailing me, and it's terrible. You know, they don't know who they are, they don't know what they are, they don't know where they belong, they don't know which civilization to identify with, and I know that they have been, it might well be that two individuals of different races met and fell in love, and it just happened, but also we can't deny that that has been facilitated and encouraged by cultural forces which want as many mixed race people as possible, precisely because it creates this identity crisis whereby they don't belong anywhere. And then, they are the ideal consumer, and also they're the ideal thorn in the side of any ethno-nationalist, because their presence requires you to say, you're half us, but you're half like us, but you're not enough like us. So it is a horrible thing. It's a horrible situation. And again, my solution for them would be they can stay, but they can only reproduce with other mixed race people, and they can only have one child per couple, because again, that would reduce their numbers.
I would say something similar, but I think you could let them have two children. I think the problem, the most important thing is that you incentivize you know, white people to have kids. And the other thing I will say, of course, is that in this system, you would control the media. If you're in the position where you can deport all non-white people, you're in the position where you control the media. So gone would be all these kind of Tesco Christmas adverts and what have you, with all these kind of mixed race couples. Gone would be this agenda where people are being told that it's a great thing, you know, if they go out with somebody of a different race. What you would have is you would just have a natural system. Obviously, the typical role models would be a white woman and a white man, because this is a white country. And thereafter, anyone who did, you know, if a white person falls in love with a non-white person, well, then that can just be put down to nature and not to some insidious agenda. So this is another point which I wanted to put. But can I just say something else, which is that, because somebody said that if you have a non-white population within your borders, then your government can be subverted, because the people who will want to subvert you will employ the non-white population to rebel against the incumbent or the incumbent, you know, white government. And I do understand that point, but what I will say is that, I mean, if Britain was totally white and there were outside forces looking to subvert the incumbent government, all they would do is they would back the Welsh, or they'd back the Scottish, or they'd back the poor. And if you look at things like the French Revolution was a revolution which was based on class warfare. And again, all the revolutions which the Illuminati have fomented in the Arab world have basically been one set of Muslims against another set of Muslims, or one set of Arabs against another set of Arabs. So the point that I wanted to make is that even if you have a totally homogenous society, the elites who want to get control of your government or subvert you or make things bad, they will do this using any kind of underclass or ethnic minority, and they've got a history of doing that.
Yeah. So the solution is to not give them a way in by building up your own group's identity, your own people's identity, so that they are resistant to and resentful of attempts to, you know, foment revolution and foment resentment in them, you know, yes, whether it's interclass or interreligious or whatever. Again, this is definitely a thing, you know. This is something that does concern me, because on the one hand, it's easy to point to the outsider and say he's the outsider, but then, well, what are we? We don't really know that at this stage. We've forgotten it, and mm-hmm. I think that is not a terminal problem. I'm not even sure if it's that serious a problem. It's one of those things where it could be solved simply, but the willpower needs to be there. And right now, the willpower is not there. It's like with depression. One of the analogies I used way back when was, it's like having a car that just doesn't have any petrol in it, but the petrol mm-hmm. station is only like 10 feet away, but the car cannot get to the petrol station. So, you know, it's this ridiculous situation. If we just had the willpower, we could do this, but mm-hmm. we don't. And that's the problem. So, I think we need to build up our own identity, and then perhaps a lot of problems will actually solve themselves. I suspect that a very large reason why we are so pliable now in the face of the globalists and whatever is that our own identity has been just pulverized. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've even been taught to be ashamed of having an identity and valuing an identity. So yeah. We're just putty at this stage, and that's not good for us, and it doesn't feel good. It's not like a pleasant situation for us to be putty. It's miserable. Mm-hmm. You know, it's in the same way that being clinically depressed might be comfortable, but that doesn't mean that it's pleasant or good for you or enjoyable. No. You know, it's comfortable, but it's not good for you. And I think in the same way, being the playthings of international elites and so on, as a result of being psychologically broken down, might be a comfortable situation just because it's familiar, but that does not mean that it's not slowly destroying you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the other thing that I wanted to say is that I'm not disagreeing with the alt-right in the sense that all of this, the whole process of immigration was a bad idea from the beginning. It was a conspiracy from the beginning. It was, you know, it was done in order to screw us over. I'm not in any way disputing these things, but essentially what I'm saying is that once the egg has been scrambled, it's just too difficult to unscramble it.
Well, I understand that. There are two things here. First of all, genetics cannot be, I mean, once you've mixed two races, that's it. Short of genetic engineering, there is no way to unscramble that egg. But if you're talking in more psychological, spiritual terms, I think you can unscramble that egg. You simply have to, I mean, imagine if tomorrow it was mandated that education, you know, the curriculum in England had to basically tell English children, you're English, and here's what it means, and here are 100 stories to link you to your past. I think that would unscramble this egg pretty damn quickly, to be honest. And it really would not be an arduous process. I think it'd be quite easy.
Well, here's what I'll say is that I was going to say the current political zeitgeist is completely against the notion of an ethno state and deporting, you know, mixed race people, etc. But of course, the thing is that if you could control the media and you could propagandize the entire zombie population, you could convince them that an ethno state was a good idea, etc., etc. Of course, the problem for the alt-right is you're never going to control the media. And however much reach you are developing in the alternative media, the alternative media is never going to be competitive with the mainstream media, because the alternative media cannot reach the zombies. And you can't reach the zombies if you're in the alternative media. The alternative media caters for those people who are looking for answers, who are thinking about things. And that is why it's why the alt-right and the alternative media will never have the reach that the mainstream media has. And that is why I just think it's completely against the current political zeitgeist that you will ever sell this notion of having an ethno state.
Well, there's the cliche of, was it Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels? And Marx said that once upon a time, global communism consisted of him and Engels in the British Library studying. Mm-hmm. You know, everything has to start somewhere. Now, this, in the case of the alt-right, this links with something I was saying to that guy T earlier on. We are at a certain juncture in the development of the alt-right, or what would more accurately be termed identitarianism at this stage. And that is that we have the choice of whether to remain a subculture for, you know, various malcontents like myself and, you know, misfits and pissed off people and so on, or to become something more accessible to the mainstream, which does not mean compromising our principles, by the way. It simply means making them accessible and amenable to the main, to people in general, to the people who are not curious. You know, the people who do just think, hey, I've got enough money to buy this car, that's fantastic, and, you know, hope I die before I get old. indeed, they are the hardest people to get to precisely because they're so myopic. But that's how culture, you know, every culture eventually has to, every cultural movement, social movement eventually does have to reach those people and get through to them. Otherwise, it just dies and nothing is achieved. And the fact that so many cultural social movements have gone somewhere and have, you know, worked out one way or the other throughout history means that this is far from an unprecedented task. It's one that has been achieved many times before.
What I would say to that, especially with the example of communism, in my opinion, was developed by the elites. Or at the very least, it was made big by the elites, by the people who control the media.
I do agree with that. Yeah, in the case of communism.
Yeah. So what I'm saying is, unfortunately, the alt-right is pretty much dependent on being, you know, granted certain privileges by the mainstream media. And at the minute, that is just the exact opposite is happening. The mainstream media is portraying you as cartoonish Nazis. And unless and until there is a change in that, you are always going to have a very limited reach. And therefore, the idea of being able to sell this notion of an ethno state, I just can't see it happening. Apart from the fact that I don't believe it is necessary, but even if you wanted to do it, I think the political zeitgeist is so far away from being that you really, I wouldn't personally, I would not be advocating this or even thinking about this because it's just...
Well, first of all...
It's such a horrible...
Yeah. First of all, it's not the ethnostate that is necessary. It's the assertion of European identity, British identity, English identity. That's what's necessary. The ethnostate would emerge either from that naturally over time, or it would be demanded by that naturally over time. I mean, one way or another. Or it wouldn't matter anymore because people would have that identity anyway and they would know to preserve it. They would care about it. So yes. It's not the building of the ethnostate that should be a goal. The goal should be getting through to a majority of white people, or at least not even a majority, just a sizable enough percentage that they can spread the word and it becomes the new normal. Now, in terms of, you're damn right that the mainstream media has enormous power. But we also know that the average age of the viewers of the mainstream media is very high. It's like, I think it's 62 for CNN. And that's remarkable. Mm-hmm. So the real war is online. And, that's where we have to concentrate our efforts. One thing I would say is that I think that in the case of the alt-right, 2 years ago, we were not a stereotypical nationalist bunch of people. Mm-hmm. A year ago, more of those older types had come in and had arrived, and or younger people were, if we were joining the alt-right, were presenting in that way just because for irony purposes or whatever. And then by the time of Charlottesville, the mainstream media, there were enough of those types in the alt-right, and the alt-right was beginning to behave in ways, well, to do rallies, for example. Mm-hmm. And so the mainstream media was able to paint the entire movement in that way as seekers of violence, even though that was clearly... we can go into how dishonest that was. It doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. The fact is mm-hmm. that the optics that we were presenting were optics that could be completely twisted. And so what I'm getting to, I think that we in the alt-right or whatever, identitarianism worldwide, could get far smarter about how we present ourselves and the opportunities that we give to the mainstream media to misrepresent us. It's a lot of it is just don't say a particular sentence or statement or phrase that can be misconstrued. Just don't say it. And, you know, I've said things in the past that I would not say today because they can be misconstrued. And so nowadays, it's a shame, but nowadays I have to be far more careful about these things because you're up against people who literally want to misrepresent every fucking thing that they can that comes out of your mouth. Mm-hmm. But this is a thing. We have to be far more sensible about that and really think ahead so that we are not... Or so that we can minimize the extent to which we can be misrepresented. Because the truth is, no, in the alt-right, are not stereotypical racists or neo-Nazis or whatever. That just does not marry up with my conception of the community. It really is something. I mean, I don't even know if that is the way those old, like white nationalism 1.0, I don't know if that was... really like that, or if it was just really a bunch of normal people who happened to have a bunch of skinheads with them who were the ones who always got into the newspaper photos. Well, it doesn't matter. You know, it's historical. But the point is that we can be, I think, smarter about how we present ourselves to the public.
Yes, but I think, can I move on to the second question? Because it's exactly what you've just mentioned there. And I will tell you what the answer to that question is that you just asked. Is that all nationalist movements from the past have been exactly the same. They've been full of good people who understood what the problem was. But in the media, they've been represented as just skinheads and louts and people who want to dish out a packy bashing or something like this. This is absolutely what my second question was about, is that I'm really interested to know from you why you think the British Nationalist Party failed and why have other nationalist movements failed?
Well, I'm always wary of naming individuals or blaming individuals because God knows they were up against a very unsympathetic mainstream media. Mm-hmm. In the case of the BNP, I don't know. I will not pretend to know that much about the history or demise of the BNP. Because honestly, when the BNP peaked and died, I still wasn't an ethno-nationalist. It wasn't really of interest to me, to be honest. But what I would say is, I think that they did not... I'll tell you what. I think that the BNP deliberately appealed, reached out to the working class. And I have a lot of affection for the working class. I don't want to disparage them. But the point, that the fact of the matter is that they don't present well. And that's... It's fucking annoying. I wish it weren't so, but it is the case. And I'm convinced that we have to reach the middle class. Sure. You know, even though I have a lot of... It's not like I love the middle. I have a lot of criticisms to make of the middle class, God knows, but I think that they are essential if we're to actually get anywhere. So one thing that I would definitely say is, if you're trying to get to reach the middle class, to appeal to them, don't show them people who are, you know, explicitly, loudly working class, because it's just going to turn them away. They're going to think, okay, I don't want to be associated with that. I am, you know, they've got their ideas of themselves, that I'm better than that, I'm more educated than that, I'm more well-spoken than he is, and I just don't want to be associated with that type of person, which is just, you know, that's normal social signalling. And and so I think one thing that's just essential is, just if we want to get anywhere, we have to, I think it is in the nature of an ethno-nationalist movement to care about the entire social organism of a race, the working class, the middle class, the upper class. But that doesn't mean that you should put them, you know, up at the forefront of as the image of the movement. I think that's, honestly, I think that's most of the time a mistake.
Yes, I absolutely understand that. You have a loyalty to represent these people who have been totally, you know, sent up shit creek without a paddle. But on the other hand, they can sometimes hinder the movement. But what I wanted to say is that this is why I believe that the BNP failed. That the first thing is that the media just presented them as a bunch of skinheads, and they had no chance against that. The second thing is that the elites sent in their agents to get control of the party. These agents then, they started causing internal strife. They got rid of people who were good, who were dedicated, etc. They went into the media and said really stupid and ridiculous things. And then they got into fights with each other on important days. And because of all that, it was just it was kind of a piece of cake for the elites to control it. And totally derail it.
It's what we would now call a shit show.
So I guess my question is, why will the alt-right be any different?
Well, it might not be. You know, this is a challenge. This is something that we've got to be fucking well aware of. Because, yes, indeed. You know, we recently had this Thoughtgate thing, the trad thought nonsense. And it seems to me that it was orchestrated from outside. Some people think it wasn't. Some people think it was just, you know, that's a delusion, and it was entirely from within. Or, you know, whatever, a lot of people involved in it were from within the movement. But to me, it's obvious that it came from without. But even if it didn't come from without, let's deal with that possibility, because this could be replicated in future challenges to the community. Let's say the threat came from without. Then what that means is that we have to have a hierarchy in place who can detect an external threat and put the foot down on how various people in the movement should react to that external threat. Namely, don't go along with it. Don't assist it. Don't facilitate it like a fucking idiot. Rather, reject it and point your followers to reject it. That's the first thing. The other possibility, and also just to engender a sense of loyalty. I mean, it's ridiculous. If there is an external threat, if there's an external threat and it's advocating that you take action which will damage your community, then you should appraise that, reach the conclusion that this action is going to damage your community, and therefore reject that action, reject that suggestion. So simply think, would this be good for the movement or bad for the movement? You know, that's one thing. And then let's say that the threat comes from within. Well, then that's to do with, you know, rivalry, vendettas, jealousy, and again, the same thing. You have to try to be objective, detached, and think, okay, I might have a beef with this person, but does everyone else need to know about that? Is it really that important? And is the person doing good for the community, for the movement, or not? And if they are, and if your friends, your confidants tell you that that person is doing good for the movement, then you've just got to swallow your ego, swallow your pride, and not harm them, not attack them.
This is
something that I think is especially, both of these problems, I think right-wing movements are especially prone to, because right-wingers are very independent-minded, especially if you're getting into right-wing politics. That, you know, that implies that you are a bit of a malcontent already, and you don't want to be shepherded. You've got your own ideas. And also, right-wingers are obsessed with principle, even to the extent of shooting themselves in the foot, cutting off the nose to spite their face. And again, this is something that I think the left, doubtless they do have their disagreements, their internal disagreements, but I think they have a sort of faith-like solidarity, which allows them to just not get caught up in this stuff. They don't counter-signal each other. They don't punch left. They don't even apologize for Antifa, for their fucking communist shock troops. So I think that the right, we on the right have to adopt that same mindset to get out of that parochial attitude of, well, he's not exactly in agreement with me, so he's an enemy. That's retarded. And we really have to rise above it. Again, I wouldn't want to say that nationalist movements in Britain or anywhere else, including the BNP, failed for these reasons, but it does look, upon review, as if these lessons would be relevant, you know, 10 years ago.
Sure. I mean, the thing I will say about the whole Lauren Southern stuff and what have you is that whether it was engineered from outside or not, the bottom line is that it came down to the problem of feminism. Feminism, which the elites had decided upon 250 years ago, would be a brilliant thing to introduce into Western societies in order to break them down. And this is the problem, that the people that you're up against are 250 years ahead of you in terms of the planning. So that now, when you end up in this problem, really the problem is feminism. The problem is feminism, which has caused these stinking relationships between men and women, so that now you have all these men who are getting angry at these women. But the thing I want to come back to is Enoch Powell. Enoch Powell was a very powerful man, and he completely failed. And he completely failed at a time in history when there wasn't that much damage done in terms of the immigration process. And yet now, a lot later, when the process is, the process of immigration has occurred to a much larger extent, now the alt-right are sort of going on about how they can solve all the problems and indeed reverse everything and get an ethno-state. And I mean, don't you think that's a little bit, well, isn't it a little bit?
Yeah, of course it's ambition. What I would say is, Powell was operating at a time when 74% of the public agreed with him, but presumably a very large percentage, perhaps equal, perhaps greater than that, also believed, well, it's not that serious because my town's still white.
Yeah.
You know, my street is still white. My kid is still in an all-white class at school. So I don't need to do anything here. You know, well, that delusion, it wasn't a delusion at the time. It was true. Britain was massively white back then. In 1968. But that situation no longer pertains. And now white people who aren't, the reason that they had that attitude is that they have solidarity up until the point where it affects their fucking social status. And then they get very individualistic and pragmatic. Yeah. Well, that can no longer be the case, because increasingly there are no places where you can white flight to. There are no schools which will A, be majority white for very much longer, and B, will not fill your child's head with Marxist claptrap. And just in general, the media is now awash. I mean, you saw the Christmas adverts that everyone else was outraged by.
Yeah.
You know, the propaganda is ramping up to 10. And I think that, why are they doing that? Why are they doing that? Why did they do the migrant crisis? You know, I think it's because they sense that whites are beginning to wake up. And so they have to just get the job done, get it finished as quickly as possible, thinking that it will be a fait accompli. But actually, well, their error in calculation is that actually that might be the thing which really does make white people wake up, which I think it does. I think it is, because demonstrably, the migrant crisis woke a lot of people up. Sure. You know, there are people in the movement today who, at the start of 2015, would not have dreamt of one day being identitarians.
Mm-hmm. Well, listen, that's an absolutely good point, and I absolutely agree. And the other thing I would say, the other thing which distinguishes the alt-right from the BNP, is that you have, you have the internet to your advantage. And listen, I will say something, because this time last year, I said the alt-right is going nowhere. Going nowhere is that, and this was after the NPI conference. And I knew that the media optics on you were just awful. And this, a year later, I've kind of changed my opinion, not in terms of what the media is doing to you, because the media optics are still going to be dreadful for you. You know, they still are dreadful. We saw that with Charlottesville. But you have done one thing which I never thought you'd be able to do, and that is to start red-pilling the skeptic community and the alt-light. And that, I mean, I'd had experience with the skeptic community, you know, a year ago, and I thought, fucking hell, these people are not going to understand anything. They're totally cretinous. But the alt-right has moved from a fringe movement, and almost YouTube is sort of like a war now between the alt-right and the skeptic community. And the alt-light has somewhat been, you know, deposed. All the kind of old school Paul Joseph Watson, Ben Shapiro, Stephen Crowder, these kind of people have that much relevance. And there's been people like Lauren Southern, and of course Black Pigeon Speaks, and Sticks, I guess, and quite a series of what you would call alt-righters who haven't disavowed the alt-right. They've said, you know, they don't agree with them on everything, but they haven't disavowed you either. So I would say that in terms of an internet community, you are definitely growing. But here's the kicker, because I think the problem is that you're not going to grow fast enough in the next sort of 10 years. And therefore, what I would say for the alt-right is that I think you're going to be very much like, you're going to suffer the same fate as the BNP in the next 10 years. But then maybe in the next 20 or 30 years, once you've accrued more followers, there might be a different, you know, you might be more popular. The problem, of course, then is that the demographics will be absolutely screwed.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and that's why this has to be exponential. We have to red pill as many people as possible, as fast as possible. There is no choice. Because as you say, the demographics are creeping up on us all the time. And, once the baby boomers die out, the demographics are going to change very rapidly. You know, over the course of the death of that generation, the demographics of Britain and indeed every other European country are going to darken, let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. So this is, again, we don't actually have that long. We don't have 20 years to do this, or 30 years. I think this is a battle that will be fought in various ways over the course of this century, but the composition of the armies and the spiritual strength of the armies will be set over the next 10 years. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's just critical.
Sure.
And I also think that's why they're increasing immigration as much as they can in the meantime. Because I think they know this. I think they know this.
I mean, I personally think if we get an SJW government come in, they might just have mass immigration, unlimited immigration. So I think it could just get, you know, consecutively worse. I think that's also a possibility.
Yeah, it is. It is. But then you can also think about using your enemy's energy against them, because the worse it gets, in a sense, the better it gets.
Yes.
In terms of the chances of nationalist identitarian uprising.
Yeah, sure.
You know, it's a matter of balancing, or it's a matter of competing forces that are very powerful but also very delicate, and they have to be directed very precisely. And that's what the next 10 years is going to consist of, I think.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you another question? So how can you be sure that the alt-right will not just be a kind of a very extremist opposition, which will only end up propping up the status quo. And what I mean by this is that there are a lot of people out on the street now who think, oh my God, what's going on? We've got Islam, we've got immigration, we've got terrorism. What the hell's going on? But then if they look over to the right for some kind of solution and they see the alt-right there, and the alt-right are talking about ethno-states and deporting mixed-race people, they're likely to just hold up their hands and in despair and think, oh, well, that's not a viable option either. And because of this, what happens is that the status quo is essentially maintained and nothing happens. And this is what I want to say, is that how can you be sure that the alt-right is not just going to be used as sort of useful idiots to help maintain the flow of immigration? Because, it, I mean, let's face it, at the minute we're at 85% white population. And if the alt-right is too extreme, I don't think they'll change anything. And so the population will go down to 80 and then 75, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas if the alt-right was just let's suppose the alt-right had these two aims. They had the aim of ending mass immigration and the aim of ending anti-white rhetoric. If you had those two aims, you might appeal to a larger base and thus be able to get more stuff done. For example, like, you know, stopping the flow of immigrants. And of course, you know, if we look at those two aims, to stop immigration and to stop the anti-white rhetoric, well, the alt-right pretty much agree with you on that. Sargon and the skeptics would pretty much agree with you, or at least Sargon would. And also you'd have a very wide base for that. And of course, the thing is, and this is what I want to stress, is that if you are really ever to get an ethno-state, you're going to have to do these two things first. You're going to have to stop immigration and you're going to have to stop the anti-white rhetoric. So isn't it surely more pragmatic for the alt-right to concern themselves solely with those two aims at the present time?
Yeah, I think that's probably true. The only thing I would add to it is that it is also worth having a long-term goal in people's minds. Although perhaps that's more applicable in more collectivist societies like Germany than it is in somewhere like Britain. But I think it is worth having in people's minds what the long-term point of this is. It's not just so that we can be mean to, you know, Mr. Ahmed and his five kids. It's so that, you know, I'm speaking in very stereotypical terms, obviously. It's not just so that we can be mean to people. It's so that we can assert and secure our life, our existence. And that is a long-term thing. And it's not something that will be secured over a matter of years. It's something that will be secured over a matter of decades. So I think that people need to think not just about... I mean, I would stop third world immigration utterly. I would just stop, reduce it to zero.
Yes.
And I know that, you know, Britain is an island, so it absolutely is possible. And anyone, you know, it's ridiculous. This is what's so infuriating. And if they wanted to stop it, they could. They just could.
Yeah,
and absolutely. So the fact that they don't do it means that they just don't have the will. And whether it's because they don't want to be condemned by the Guardian, or whether it's because they themselves are brainwashed, you know, at Oxford, or because they're being paid by whatever, Soros or whatever, whoever, it doesn't really matter. Whatever the reason is, our politicians are traitors, and they are not prepared to even. I mean, you know, they drivel. They drivel about reducing immigration. They talk about net migration, which, for a start, that's just a disgusting lie to talk about net migration. And I did a video about this early on, about how dishonest it is to talk about net migration. But they talk about that, and they talk about reducing net migration to tens of thousands. Well, why not just zero? I don't believe that our economic systems are so fragile that we need this constant influx of new people, especially when the new people are coming from, frankly, low IQ countries. And what are they going to do? Do we really not have white people who can do those jobs? I don't believe that.
No, and you're absolutely right. And it's completely ridiculous. I mean, where I live now, all the taxi drivers are Asian. Is it really not possible for white people to drive taxis? I mean, the whole thing is a complete con, and it always has been. So I'm completely with you, and I think most people are with you with the immigration stuff. But I think something else I wanted to say is that there are plenty of people in the alt-right. They won't criticize the alt-right on certain issues, And yet, because they're scared of losing subscribers, or they are just scared of the alt-right sort of, you know, the rank and file. They don't want to be trolled by the alt-right. But I don't really believe that most people in the, certainly in the alt-right, will be up for an ethno-state or deporting, you know, all non-whites, et cetera, et cetera. And I certainly, I also think there are people in the alt-right who will not do these things either. People, for example, like Bray for show, or Tara McCarthy, or indeed the libertarian Eli Mosley. I honestly can't believe that these people will ever be up for deporting mixed race people, nor either will they ever be up for things like telling people who they can and can't have sex with. And I think, I just think there's a lot of kidology going on here. There's a lot of kidology, and people don't want to kind of say, you know what, I'm not really on board with that, because they're scared of losing subscribers. They're scared of upsetting the rank and file, you know, alt-right army, online army. They're scared of being called a cuck. But I think at some point you're going to have to recognize the reality that people are not up for pure ethno-states and this kind of thing.
Well, again, the thing about the pure ethnostate is a consideration for later on. At this stage, the goal is to foment white identity. You know, yes. And again, we'd bring that down to British, English identity and Swedish identity and so on. So that's the goal. As for those particular people, I don't know Bree Fouché very well at all. I've only spoken to her once, and that was the other night. Tara... I don't know her that well, but I think she does understand the gravity of the situation. Eli Mosley, I don't know very well, but I think the point is, I think that as this idea intensifies, as it surely will, I think a lot of people will come round to accepting that if we want our people to survive, then we do need to not force certain things upon people, but certainly encourage and discourage certain behaviours in people. And you know, that's how society has always worked. So it's not unusual. It's just, it seems strange and bizarre because right now it's contrary to the prevailing orthodoxy. But, you know, the prevailing orthodoxy changes. And it changes actually quite fast, you know?
That is absolutely true. But what I would say is, again, it comes back to this thing. If you are to ever really have power, you will have control at the macro level. And so you can control the macro demographics. You will have Christmas adverts which show a white person with a white person. And therefore, the vast majority of the sheeple will follow what they are shown on television. Now, and for that reason, I don't think you have to think on those grand levels and not on this kind of trailer park trash level of, oh, well, you know, the person next door to me is going out with a black guy or something. I need to interfere with that. I think you have to work on the macro level, and it can all be manipulated, because like I say, you will set the role models. You will give people the television superstars and what have you. They will all be, you know, there will be examples of white culture and British culture, et cetera, et cetera. And so people will follow those examples. And of course, as the alt-right is very fond of saying, people have in-group preferences. So the majority of people anyway, if they're left to their own devices and they're not fed this insidious propaganda, I think they will self-select along racial lines anyway. And so it's not really a problem.
Yeah. Again, I mean, this is something where I'm not saying that we should advocate for an extreme option necessarily. What I'm saying is that we simply have to build up white identity for now and then see, well, then what is necessary? Because as you say, it might be that is enough to shape white people so that they are prepared to accept zero immigration and all the rest of it. Or it might be that we do need to ramp up our efforts at persuading our propaganda and so on, and our cultural push. So that might be necessary, but for now what I want to do is, as I've said, just really spread the idea that it's okay to be white, it's good to be white, and make more white people. and, you know, and care about being, you know, it's not like it's okay to be white, as in it's acceptable, it's not a crime, you don't need to be ashamed of it. No, we should be saying, be glad to be white.
Yes.
You know, just as everyone else is glad to be what they are.
Sure. And in this hypothetical situation I'm talking about, that would absolutely be the case. Everybody would understand that you have to genuflect to the native population, the people who built Western civilization. And there's a lot of kind of, there seems to be this argument in on the online community between civic nationalism and ethno-nationalism. And of course, the civic nationalism, as proposed by someone like Crown Tea, where everyone is replaced by Chinamen, and, you know, it doesn't really, racial identity is meaningless. That sort of civic nationalism is really, really stupid. But what I'm trying to say here is that there is a brand of civic nationalism where you have a white majority and everyone genuflects to that host culture, that native culture. That is something which can work. And again, I'm not saying that I don't understand that what the alt-right is saying, which is that none of this should ever have happened in the first place. But I'm also saying that now that it's happened, you have to kind of work for a practical, pragmatic solution.
Yeah.
Hello?
Of course. Yes, yeah. Sorry, I'm here. I'd muted. Yes, of course we do. And I think there is, again, as I was saying earlier to, I think it was that guy, T, at the start of a movement, there is idealism, but gradually that does give way to realism and pragmatism and practical ideas. And but obviously the ideal remains the ideal. I mean, it's not like you just forget about it, but you do start to get more realistic about how to achieve it and which stages are necessary along the way. And maybe there will be some softening of the ideal in order to for it to be achievable, because you can never let perfect be the enemy of good. You know, you have to, there might well have to be some compromises. But yeah, I don't think, see, this is something that I'm just not worried about at this stage. I think that we simply have to keep growing the movement. But also I think there does need to be more hierarchy. I think there needs to be a firm structure to the community. Because right now it's just a movement. It's just kind of chaos. And I think that worked well in 2015 and 2016, but I don't think it works well now. I think really 2017 has changed everything and brought about the necessity for more direction, more discipline. Because after all, you know, in 2016 we had the direction of the Trump election, so yes, that gave people purpose and a common purpose, gave them a unifying goal. But we don't have that now, and so we're vulnerable. We're vulnerable to infighting and all this nonsense. So I think that a long-term solution for that is to have more of a firm hierarchy in place. But yeah, to get back to the point, I think that the key is our own identity as a people. And political solutions, political goals should follow on from that once we're able to ascertain what the situation is after that.
Yeah,
that's what I would say.
Yeah, I would say 2017, though. I would say that's 2016, you had Trump. 2017, you've completely fucked up Crown Tea and the skeptics. So I wouldn't say you've lost direction in this. Yes, I think you've had really, you know, very good growth. But can I just come to a final thing that I really wanted to ask you, which is, how can you not be sick of white people? How can you not look at all look at all white nationalist movements from the past, look at how they fail, and not just despair and think this is the fault of white people?
Because the people who comprise white nationalists or any political movements do not constitute the entirety of the white race. I might not like some of the personality types involved in the alt-right.
Any million. Sorry, I think I mean, how can you not hate the white people who have pissed on the white nationalists?
Oh, you mean like, for example, the journalists in Antifa who doxed me, that sort of thing?
Precisely.
Well, you know, I don't like them, and I wish them. I don't enthusiastically wish them a Merry Christmas. Let's put it that way. But they don't make me hate the white race, because that would be, well, then they would have beaten me, wouldn't they? That would be defeat for me if I were to be embittered against my whole people, like the Scottish but people, because of some shitheads.
But surely, for me personally, when I look at the vast majority of white people, they are completely complicit in their own demise. It is their fault that they are letting this happen. They're either completely indifferent, or they're virtue-signaling liberals, or they're absolute pillocks like Crown Tea. And I look at these people, and I don't have any love for them. I don't have any love for them, and it is their fault. And I don't understand the collectivism of the alt-right when presented with this moment in history where white people are screwing themselves over as best they can. I don't know how you can take away from that some kind of group loyalty to these people. I can't stand them.
The answer is, I would say, the answer is that you have to forgive. Because the same tendencies that are currently working against white people and compelling them to do these silly things, like sing a song for a migrant, and so on, those very same tendencies would, in a different situation, cause them to do good things.
Well, I kind of understand what you're saying, but I was able to break through the conditioning, and fairly easily, I would say. And the thing I want to say was, there have been nationalists in the past who they've been absolutely wrecked and ruined, and absolutely screwed over by media. They've been put in prison. And at the end of it all, they said, you know what, it wasn't worth it, because the very people who you are trying to defend, they come to your public execution and they throw eggs in your face. And let me put this situation to you. Let's suppose 10 years' time, the alt-right crashes and burns, and you are put in prison, you're hounded by the media, some young white people come to your granddad's funeral, and they throw crap at you, and they draw a swastika. Dave, are you honestly going to turn around then and say, oh, well, they're still my race? They're still, yes. I've still got some connect. No, don't tell me yes, Woz, please. Yes. No. Really?
Yes. Yes.
You're a sadomasochist.
No. No, I'm an ethno-nationalist.
Please explain the logic of enjoying.
It's not a matter of logic. It's not a matter of logic. It's certainly not a matter of enjoying that. It's simply a matter of looking beyond the present situation and understanding that whether I like them or not, and whether they like me or not, we are connected. And it's they who are betraying that connection, and it would not become me to also betray it.
You wouldn't be angry? You wouldn't be broken and bitter?
I'd be angry. I might well be broken, but I hope that I wouldn't become bitter. But of course, that's up to me at the time. And it's easy to say this in advance, but who knows how I would emotionally react to that level of betrayal. But it's always a choice of how to react to betrayal. Distort you or not.
But they would never, ever, ever appreciate what you were trying to do for you. They would always think you're the bad guy, and they would kick you into the gutter and cheer and think they did a good thing.
Well, I'm not doing this for their approval.
Ah, well, okay. Here's the thing, because I don't think you do care about the white race. I think I care more about the white race in the sense that I'm willing to say to some specimens of the white race, you ain't worth shit, and you are letting this race down, so you go bugger off. I really think it's completely against a kind of eugenic ideal that it doesn't matter how stupid or ridiculous or idiotic or anti-white certain white people are, the alt-right seems to forgive them. I don't get that at all. It's anti-eugenic.
Let me intervene there, because I do believe in eugenic progress. I mean, I think that you should want your people to become as good as they can become. But that doesn't mean having contempt for them in the lowly or average or mediocre state that they might happen to be in just now. A child is not the genius that he might become one day, but that doesn't mean that you should have contempt for him today while he's, shitting himself and screaming and all the rest of it. He has the potential to become something great. And so you should love him even in this vulnerable and lowly state so that he might well one day become that.
The vast majority of people have no potential. If you're standing, if you're out advocating for, if you're lighting a candle after a terrorist attack, that you don't have any potential. You're absolutely useless. You're beyond help. You're moronic. That person is worth nothing to me. TJ Kirk Chris Reagan, Sargon of Akkad, Crown Tea, these people are worth nothing to me. How can you romanticize these people?
Well, because if I didn't, I might hate them. And then I would be alone and I would have won nothing. Are you still there? You've gone silent, Thomas. Oh, God. We've got another technical error. Oh, God. What's he doing? What's he got on? Hold on, everyone. I'll send him a message. I suspect he's lost his connection. In more ways than one, perhaps. He seems quite atomized. Oh, he's just dropped out. God, I hope he hasn't... Ah, here he is. Hello, Thomas.
Hello, sorry about that. Was that... I don't know what happened there.
It happens sometimes. You lose the connection. Okay, so you were in the middle of saying, how can you romanticize these people and so on. Look, it's not a matter of... And here's something. My analogy was perhaps not the best one. An individual child could become a genius, or it could become a very charitable person, or whatever. In the case of people, members of a collective, yes, it's important not to romanticize the individual members of that collective. But that doesn't mean that you shouldn't see them as representatives of it and examples of it. Now, they might not be the best, they might be crap examples of the collective, but that doesn't mean that the collective as a whole should be besmirched by them, you know, or that you should allow that to happen in your head. Because again, you don't benefit from that. It's a matter of seeing the best in things.
It's a case of, yeah, I'm not disagreeing. There aren't great white people out there. I'm happy to support the alt-right in the sense that they are intelligent enough to be red-pilled, but I cannot go in for this universal collectivism of people who are so unbelievably stupid that they light a candle after a terrorist attack. I just don't get that. But let me put something else to you, because when I hear you say things like securing a future for the for white children, do you know what I think? I'm so dismayed that you would couch things in those terms. And I will tell you something. The reason that liberals, the liberal virtue signalers, and people like Sargon of Akkad, the reason they will come along and counter signal you when you say things like that, ultimately, subconsciously, what they're doing is they are securing a future for their own bloody children, right? That's the thing. By getting on board with what is expected of them in terms of the mainstream political consensus, what they're really doing is they're looking out for number one, and therefore, as a consequence, they're looking out for their own children. But on the other hand, when alt-righters talk about, you know, securing a future for white children, all you're doing is you are socially ostracizing yourself, you're risking financial ruin, imprisonment, etc. And therefore, you're less likely to pass on your genes. You will have less children than the likes of the smug liberals or the, you know, people like Sargon. So ultimately, can you not see that there's something really stupid about this? They're all playing a different game to you. They're being incredibly selfish and looking after their own genes and their own children. And you are trying to go out of your way to help them. And yet they're stabbing you in the back to the point where you will have less chance of passing on your own genes.
Well, that is an interesting dichotomy. I haven't thought of it like that before, I have to admit. But again, I don't think it negates the overall point of caring about your people. I mean, it might happen in an unjust way that one's political activism as a nationalist detriments one's chances of reproducing.
Absolutely.
But that doesn't mean that the goal of nationalism is therefore stupid. It just means that one makes a sacrifice in the service of it.
Let's be clear about something. I'm not saying it's stupid. I'm not saying you guys are wrong. What I'm saying is that that's got nothing to do with whether or not you'll be successful. And all that people like Sargon are doing, they're just being pragmatic, and they're securing the existence of their own line. And I want to say something, because the alt-right makes a big deal about race being like an extended family. But let's be clear, family is a massive, massive bond. And race is so unbelievably secondary to that. You know, there's not really any comparison. And that's what we're seeing today. Nobody, if you go, let's suppose you're smeared in the media tomorrow, nobody will stand up for you, or let's say you get sent to prison. No one will step out of line in order to help you. Everyone will just toe the line, they'll keep their mouths shut. And the reason is that because they want to preserve themselves, and by extension, they want to preserve their families. They don't want to get sacked from their jobs because they've got mouths to feed. So everyone is playing a completely different game to you, and you're being totally altruistic. But can't you see that sucks in the long run?
Well, it sucks for me.
Exactly.
It's a choice, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it sucks for my people in general. You know, my activities, my work, might well benefit them. Hopefully it will. It's up to me to do my best. The fact that I might not be thanked for it by my people in general, or even the fact that I might be betrayed by them for it, is by the by. You know, the sheeple are the sheeple, the rabble, the meek, whatever you want to call them. Yes, they do have to be shaped and directed. And it's really a battle between different forces that are vying for that power, for that authority. But this is just how life works. This is how society works. You can't blame the meek for being meek. This is what I was saying in my video about Stefan Molyneux. You know, you can't have contempt for the public in general for being the way they are. That's placing a demand, an expectation upon them that they cannot possibly fulfill. And so therefore you're condemning yourself to be perpetually dissatisfied with them and eventually bitter towards them, which doesn't benefit you either.
So you're saying that you completely forgive the people who came to your house and doxed you and
not those individuals. Obviously I don't have a tremendous amount of goodwill towards them. Although again, I would say that they're just, you know, idiots and misled, probably troubled in their own ways, who knows? And a lot of them, others will not be troubled. They'll be spoiled middle-class brats. But whatever, that, again, their behavior does not reflect on the totality of my people.
But listen, to repeat, I've got no problem with you having in-group loyalties to all the white people who are on your side, and even the ones who are sort of, let's say, indifferent. But for the ones who will happily stab you in the back in order to secure their own futures, I don't get that. But I will say I admire your humility. Maybe you've got something which I don't, because I get very angry and bitter about things. And I do admire, if you genuinely are, you know, humble like that and at peace like that, then, you know, maybe that's something I should admire.
I think it's important not to get bitter about these things, because you don't benefit from that, you know, personally. And it doesn't help you. It certainly doesn't help you to get along with people in general. You can be exasperated with them, but you must not allow that to transform into bitterness or resentment. Mm-hmm. You have to accept people the way they are. Now, when I say the totality of my people, that does not mean that I love every individual among them, or even any individual among them. It simply means that as a collective entity, I care about my people. But the individuals within it, yeah, there are shitheads. There are white psychopaths and sociopaths and all the rest of them, and traitors. And yeah, I despise them. But again, that doesn't affect my perception of the thing as a whole, of the group as a whole. Because if I did allow that to happen, I think that would be inaccurate. And it would be unfair, and also selfishly, it wouldn't benefit me.
Sure. Yeah. Woes, I'm looking at the time and I'm thinking I've overstayed my welcome here.
Hey, I'm not in a bad mood with you. This has been a really interesting conversation. But yeah, I'm supposed to start the next one in about 15 minutes. So yeah, I suppose we probably should wrap this one up. We did go through all the questions. Let me just get them, the emails up
yes,
again.
We did. We went through them.
Yes, we did. No, that's good. Cool. That wraps up quite well.
Sure. Can I just quickly make a few final points?
Yes.
Okay. There was one brief thing which I didn't mention, which is that sometimes when the alt-right talk about an ethno-state and get it into their heads that this is a real viability, I think what happens is the left then think, oh my God, there's going to be this ethno-state. And so the insane SJW left, then they just dig in harder. And they also buy into this belief that there could be an ethno-state. And also people in the middle ground, like Roaming Millennial or Bunty King, they also, they also think, oh my God, there could be this ethno-state. And so it's kind of like folie à deux. I really don't think that it's totally counterproductive, I think, for the alt-right to talk about an ethno-state. And that was just a brief point that I wanted to make. But the final thing that I wanted to say, just to wrap up, if that's okay with you, Rose, is that I'm worried for you. I'm worried for you on two levels. First of all, I'm worried that you could end up in some very serious trouble in a political sense, and that you could ruin yourself. And all I would say to that is just be careful with some of the themes that you go for. And the second thing I wanted to say, where I'm worried for you, I'm worried that you're somehow connecting up all your spiritual life with this need to get an ethno state. And I think that's a very, perhaps, because when it happens, or if and when it happens that you don't get an ethno state, I don't want that to be a big blow, you know, big slap across the face. And the thing,
but also, even going further than that, even if the ethno state did transpire in my lifetime, even that shouldn't be the be all and end all of my existence. Mm-hmm. You know, and this is something that I have become aware of more recently in the last few months, that yeah, I should be talking about things other than race, you know, just for my own health, and and just so that my channel isn't one note and boring. So yeah, I think you're right on both absolutely things that you said there.
Yeah, absolutely. When I, you know, the advert that you create for Millennial is just, it's brilliant. You've got the lovely kind of the burning log, you've got the, you know how to do the sounds and the musical effects. You know, you're very talented on certain things, and I don't want to see you ruined, as I've seen previous white nationalist ruins. I don't want that to happen to you. I think you've got a lot of talent, a lot of creative talent, and I hope that you will just toe a reasonable line, let's say, and not go too far, because you know, you have some good talents, and you should concentrate, and you should be a bit more selfish, is what I'm saying, because you've taken an awful lot of risks, and you don't need to keep on taking risks, and you can be a bit more selfish. And the final thing that I wanted to say is that I think in the future, I think you will realize in maybe 20 years' time that the thing about the ethno state, the writing will be on the wall for that, but there will be another role for you, and that will be as the defender of white people who have become a minority, or who are on the brink of becoming a minority in their own country. I think that will be a role where you can really roll your sleeves up and do some good work. And I think that with that role, it will be something which will be totally suited to you. And also, you would have a very good chance of winning that kind of fight. And also, I'm very confident that at that stage of history, white people, most white people, will come to you and say, you know, I'm really grateful for the work you've done. Whereas I feel with the stuff with the ethno state and that hardcore stuff, I don't think that's a fight you can win. And I don't think that most white people will be particularly grateful to you on that matter.
Okay. Well, that's definitely food for thought. And thank you for giving me those perspectives. On that note, let's wrap this one up,
okay,
because it's been a very interesting discussion. I hope you've enjoyed it.
Yeah, and I'm very grateful to be here, Woz. And I will say once more to the audience, as No White Guilt said, please donate, give Millennial Woz some kind of Christmas gift, you know, some kind of PayPal transaction, because he's put in a load of work for this, and I can't imagine that it's going to be very profitable. So please, you know, please send Millennial Woz a bit of, you know, a bit of your love via PayPal.
Well, thank you very much.
All right.
Yeah, that's great. Well, thank you, Thomas Hold on a minute. I've forgotten how to, is it Baden Rees?
That's correct, yes.
Yes. Okay, well, thank you, Thomas Baden Rees, and I hope that people check out your channel. And it's been great to have you on for the first time. I mean, I've been watching you for, 12 months now, so it's nice to finally have you on. And I hope you come on again in the future.
I would love to do that, Woz. Thanks very much for inviting me. I was very, very honoured.
Okay. I'm glad you enjoyed it. Okay, and I hope that everyone who's listening has enjoyed this discussion as well. The next one will start in about 15 minutes. I'll have a wee break. And that is with... Oh, God, who is it? Oh, it's Countercurrents. Right, okay. Yeah. Okay, all right. Well, thank you, and I'll see you soon.
Cheers, Woz.